This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the nomination for Attorney General of Judge Michael Mukasey.
What's shocking here, liberals and some others have been supporting this man's nomination for Attorney General. He is very bad. We will get more of the same. More enemy combatants, more offshore prisons, more Patriot Acts, and more general lawlessness in this administration.
We'll talk with Attorney Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights and hear an update on their so-called Caterpillar case.
Caterpillar Corporation in the United States makes 60-ton bulldozers and wittingly sells them to the Israelis for house demolitions. Is this okay under U.S. foreign policy, or is it a war crime?
We will hear about an innovative legal project at the Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice.
This is an outfit that traces its history all the way back to the general strikes of the auto workers in the 30s. They're still reaching out to workers to advance the struggle.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Our next segment is about a man named Judge Mukasey, who the Bush administration has nominated to be the next Attorney General of the United States. We're going to hear from two guests, Shane Katadal, who is an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights and who runs the center's Guantanamo Project, and we will hear from Jesse Berman, who had the experience of having a trial, or part of a trial, at least a hearing, in front of Judge Mukasey for a material witness, supposed material witness, post-9/11. Both of those attorneys will tell you why Judge Mukasey is a very, very bad idea to be Attorney General. It will be continuation of what we've already had: enemy combatants, offshore prisons, conceivably torture, material witnesses, special trials for terrorists, putting really another placeholder in. We will also be getting someone who's very close to Rudolph Giuliani and his campaign, and who's actually supported the campaign and is an advisor to Giuliani. I just want to say on a personal note before we go to these two guests, how utterly dismayed I am at having Judge Mukasey as a possible attorney general. Even apart from who he is, I think that the Democrats have to stand up for something that's absolute when it comes to the next attorney general. No attorney general should be nominated or confirmed who does not stand flat against torture, flat against renditions, the sending of people away for torture, flat against the use of the term enemy combatant to classify people and deny them rights, flat against special trials for alleged terrorists, and flat against the use of the material witness warrant to hold people for no reason at all. Those are five or six of the hallmarks of this administration's really descent into lawlessness. And the idea that the Democrats would approve any attorney general who doesn't stand four square against those positions, to me, is an outrage. This is a time when we have to start changing what this country has stood for in the last half a dozen years. And if the Democrats can't stand up for it now, it is really a sad day. And worse, as you will hear, Judge Mukasey not only will fail to stand for anything positive, but in fact, he stands in the same line as Alberto Gonzalez and the others. He's upheld material witness warrants. He's advocated special trials for alleged terrorists. He's upheld and actually spoken proudly of the Patriot Act, particularly its library provision, where you can go after, librarians and what you're reading in libraries. This is a man who should not be the Attorney General. Sadly, and before we hear from our guests, I just want to say there's a number of people out there who have said it's fine, and there are a number of people who I've worked with over the past. There are liberals who are saying, well, he's smart, the Justice Department needs somebody, and we should have him. But they're looking away from what this country has become in the last 6 years. And I find it shocking to me that there's people of good faith who would actually say they could support Judge Mukasey. In the next 20 minutes, you will hear why this is a bad nomination from the get-go.
Shane, welcome once again to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Now, Shane, I've been reading some of your blogs on the Huffington Post. Are you a regular blogger there?
I am, along with apparently 1,800 other people. But they, you know, they're a relatively new site. It's about 2 years old, but they have gotten a pretty big readership. I think they have like 500,000 unique visitors every month, and a lot of folks within the Beltway. So it's a useful audience for us that we wouldn't otherwise reach. It's a good way of directing a lot of traffic to our own website also.
Recently, and what we're going to talk about today, is your blog on Mukasey, how the Center for Constitutional Rights and many of us feel about his nomination. What essentially are the main points that you covered recently?
Sure, sure. Well, the blog post entitled "Mukasey Will Suck" is basically the main points, I guess, that I make are three. You know, first of all, this is a guy who despises the legal left and the Center for Constitutional Rights in particular. He made reference to a sort of frequent misquotation of Michael Ratner, saying that, you know, quote, the director of an organization purporting to protect constitutional rights has announced that his goal is to unleash a flood of lawyers on Guantanamo to paralyze the interrogation of detainees.
Yes, go for it!
Well, Michael actually said, you can't run an interrogation and torture camp with attorneys. You know, lawyers are down there to interview their clients, and statements are going to come out on a weekly basis referring to sexual abuse, religious abuse, and the use of dogs. You know, it's a frequent misconception that somehow the Geneva Conventions or any of the other rights that we're asking for prevent the military from even asking people questions down there. They prevent coercive interrogation, and that's exactly what Michael was talking about. Now, Mukasey wrote that in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal 4 or 5 weeks ago. And it was an interesting piece. Here's a guy who was a pretty major federal court judge, had just recently retired and was in private practice at a law firm. And I think maybe now, looking back on it, that op-ed piece was a little bit of a job application. He was saying, look, I was someone who was in the middle of these cases, and I made all these rulings that people perceive as being hostile to the government. But in fact, I think it's really problematic that I was forced to make those rulings. And so, you know, he's signaling to the administration and everyone else that this is somebody who is an outsider, not a Bush administration insider like Ted Olson or some of the other candidates for the AG spot whose names were floated. Despite all that, he agreed, at a fundamental level with what the administration has been trying to do on the detention and interrogation front. And, you know, he agreed despite the fact that he was, you know, somebody who wasn't, you know, involved with formulating those policies.
He doesn't just show disdain for the Center for Constitutional Rights, but also the American Library Association when they criticized a Patriot Act provision about access to, you know, records.
That's right. And, you know, his language, you know, this is another Wall Street Journal op-ed that he published in 2004. His language, again, really betrays, I think, a deep-seated hatred for the left. You know, he couldn't restrain himself. I mean, he said, first, a word on the organization that gives us this news, and then went on to complain that they were hypocrites for criticizing their own government when they didn't say anything about the 10 librarians in Cuban prisons for exercising First Amendment sort of rights. So this is a guy who really sort of has it in for us, and I think that really gets you to kind of my second point in the blog, which is that this is a guy who, you know, for whatever position he had as a neutral referee, as a federal judge, is really obsessed with the national security angle on things, and he views it as being diametrically opposed to the notion that detainees should have rights. This is an issue that we have, I think, on the left, a hard time sort of publicizing, and it basically, I can kind of sum it up this way, that federal courts are not there to be a sort of monkey wrench in the gears of law enforcement and criminal investigations against terrorism or to defuse terrorist plots. But then, in fact, the courts are there as agents of accountability and oversight for the executive. They're there to make sure that law enforcement does a good job. For a judge to say that he thinks judges shouldn't have a role overseeing the executive and law enforcement is kind of like me saying that I don't think I should have a boss here at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I would do my job so much better if I just didn't have to worry about responding to pesky inquiries from my boss. Put it that way, I think the average American can understand that, yeah, you know, judicial review is there to make sure that the executive is following real leads and not just sort of following its prejudices and so forth. But, you know, Mukasey doesn't seem to believe that, and it's quite troubling.
He looks at courts as basically a way to put people in prison. I mean, right. Not as a way to find out whether a person has committed a crime or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really reflected in something that sort of came out in the, I believe it was the New York Times, might have been the Washington Post, a story about his treatment of some of these folks in material witness detention. This was a sort of big issue after 9/11 that the government was locking people up, not because it accused them of committing any crime, but simply because it thought they would be useful witnesses, and not even witnesses in criminal trials, but witnesses in these sort of open-ended grand jury proceedings, which are really just, you know, sort of, you know, law enforcement coming in and, you know, lecturing sort of group of 23 citizens that meets once a month on the state of certain investigations. So not time critical at all, but the government locked up about 70 men, all but one or two of them South Asian or Arab Muslim men, right after 9/11, and really abused the statute. And one of them was a guy named Osama Abdallah, and he was apparently dragged in front of Mukasey. The transcript was released to a reporter recently. His lawyer didn't know he was being moved across the country until the night before the hearing, had to get on a plane and fly overnight to be there, tried to bring in local counsel, and Mukasey rejected that, then complained that the client had been beaten, and Mukasey said, "Well, I will tell you, he looks fine to me." Now, Awadallah was wearing a jumpsuit, apparently, in this proceeding. If he had lifted up the jumpsuit, the judge would have seen his bruises. But Mukasey didn't even want to, you know, hear about that sort of thing.
You know, Shane, that's one of the more remarkable lines that I've ever heard. You have a lawyer with guys in this jumpsuit, and the lawyer says, you know, "My client's been beaten," and Mukasey says, "He looks fine to me." If there's a slogan or something that should defeat this man for attorney general, that's it. Every show trial dictator judge, you know, has ever done is basically ignore torture and beatings.
Mm-hmm. My earlier point about contempt for the legal left pops up too, because Randall Hamoud from San Diego, who was representing Awadallah when he was detained out in San Diego, wanted to bring in a local New York lawyer who's on the board of CCR, Abdin Jabara, to help defend the case. And he said, you know, Hamoud said, "Look, you know, Judge Mukasey, you know, I need somebody who's familiar with the local rules here and so forth." And Mukasey replied, apparently, and I'm quoting, "I got news for you. Mr. Jabara is not terribly familiar with the nuances of the local rules here either." So, you know, again, just the sort of contempt for the legal left sort of, you know, seething out of this man. You know, I imagine it'll continue to do so if he becomes attorney general.
Well, Shane, what are the positive aspects if he were to be confirmed, since we have so much negative stuff to dwell on?
Right. Well, you know, the things that get quoted are really, you know, three things. You know, one, that he, you know, supposedly rebuffed the government in the Jose Padilla case. He was the judge who had Padilla's case when he was had held as a material witness and then initially held as an enemy combatant. Also the idea that somehow he's the right guy to rebuild the Department of Justice, which is deeply demoralized and losing a lot of longtime career staffers, and then just generally that he's smart and is an outsider from the administration. They're really sort of false reasons. You know, first of all, in the Padilla case, you know, the emphasis is that, you know, in December 2002, the government said that we can hold this guy as an enemy combatant even though he's a U.S. citizen and even though we arrested him at O'Hare Airport.
He's the so-called dirty bomber, which will be the reference for some of our audience.
And right, that's right, although the government backed off on
right,
those charges.
Yeah.
And he was held, you know, under these conditions for 3 years, basically, without, you know, seeing a lawyer for the vast majority of that time. And,
U.S. Citizen, remember.
Mm-hmm. Right, U.S. citizen arrested inside the U.S. I mean, this is the sort of thing that even back in 2002, you know, a year after 9/11, we were sort of thinking, well, there's a chance that the courts are really going to rebuff this outright and just say it's outrageous and order him released. I mean, Mukasey didn't do that. In December 2002, one of the first opinions on these enemy combatant cases, one of the first times a judge was ruling on the administration's really, you know, ridiculously broad claims of executive power, he said, you know, look, they're entitled to hold U.S. citizens as enemy combatants like this. The only thing that Mukasey conceded was that the government had to produce some evidence that he was sort of involved in terrorism or something like that. So really a very, very minimal kind of standard. You know, and again, it's the sort of thing that if you were a smart, you know, conservative judge trying to come up with a way of looking like you were being objective without really giving the defense any chance, that's the kind of standard you would put out there. You know, then he also did say, well, he got the right to see a lawyer, but in the same opinion, he said there's no reason military personnel cannot monitor Padilla's contacts with his counsel. So he was checking off on the government listening in to attorney-client communications. He didn't have a problem with this. And again, I think that goes to the notion that, you know, this guy regards people who are asserting rights for detainees as, you know, enemies of the government, basically. All these things sort of add up, and it certainly gave, I think, a lot of momentum, legal momentum, to the government back in the first days when nobody knew whether the courts were really going to completely rebuff the Bush administration or go along with him.
One other question about another op-ed and his position on special trials for people. Did he give an opinion about that?
I believe he did, that he, in the recent Wall Street Journal editorial, he said that he thought that it was a terrible thing that we, you know, gave sort of full-on criminal defense rights to people in these, you know, sort of big transnational terrorism prosecutions. And he cites this story about bin Laden or al-Qaeda sort of figuring out that certain communications avenues that they were using, like phones or something like that, had been sort of tapped by the government. They stopped using them, or maybe it was something like a list of unindicted co-conspirators that he had cited to. Basically buying this line that other sort of lefty scholars like Neil Katyal have also put forward recently, which is that we need a third way in these kind of cases. You know, and again, it all comes back to this point that he believes, you know, giving people rights is a sort of luxury rather than a way of making sure that law enforcement and, in fact, counterterrorism investigations operate efficiently and without corruption.
You know, Shane, it reminds me a little bit. I remember when Gonzalez was suggested for attorney general after his president's counsel. The Center for Constitutional Rights was one of the few groups to start saying he shouldn't be confirmed, and then eventually it became a much wider group, even though he did get confirmed. Are we seeing the same kind of play with Mukasey? I mean, there's been more support for him than I would have ever guessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is a misperception about really how far from the government position he was. Dealing with this at a kind of newspaper story, you know, level of probing those first opinions, and so they'll think, well, it was a balanced opinion that he issued in Padilla's case, when in fact it was cleverly crafted to give the appearance of balance while being complete sort of concession to the administration's position.
One of the points on the so-called positive side might be his leadership role in rebuilding the Department of Justice, which is not in great shape right now. Any quick thoughts on his ability to do that or how he will?
Yeah, well, he doesn't have a long period of time in there, you know, and so I think a lot of that turns on the perception within the Department of Justice about him. I mean, he is supposedly an excellent administrator, and that certainly goes a long way in a big organization to sort of reversing morale declines and that sort of thing. And, you know, he certainly is smart as well, which is something that plenty of people on the left seem to think is, you know, going to magically result in him, you know, kind of coming around on some of our positions because, you know, no intelligent person could actually back up the Bush administration line on this. Of course, you know, John Yoo is a very smart guy also. Time will tell on those issues, but I think the other stuff really overwhelms it. And, you know, having no leadership for, you know, 16 months or however long is left with this administration is not going to be appreciably worse than having a guy who, you know, really sort of essentially believes that judicial review and open government and probable cause are all sort of hindrances to law enforcement.
Well, Shane, remind our listeners of how they can go read your blog.
Oh, sure. Well, the blogs are up on HuffingtonPost.com. The easiest way to get to them is just to go to the search feature and type my last name in, which is Kadidal.
Kadidal.
That's right.
Shane, and what can listeners do? I mean, I think the point you raised about people are sort of relying on what they've been reading in the mainstream press, is the center going to issue a call to oppose him?
Well, I think once the time for the hearings comes around, you'll see that from us and hopefully from some other groups as well.
Well, thank you very much, Shane.
Bye-bye.
We're here with Jesse Berman, who was a lawyer for a man named
Osama Awadalla.
And who was Osama?
He was then a 21-year-old permanent resident of the United States, a Muslim, a Palestinian. He was a student at a junior college in San Diego when he was arrested as a material witness.
He was arrested as a material witness shortly after 9/11, is that right?
Yes, he was arrested approximately September 20th of 2001 after he had spent 2 days debriefing to the FBI and voluntarily answering everything they asked him. They were interested in him because he had happened to meet two men at his mosque about 2 years earlier, although he hadn't seen them in the past year and a half, and those two men 2 years later turned out to be among the hijackers on September 11th.
Now, we're talking to Jesse Berman to get some perspective both on the government's tactics, but really about Judge Mukasey, who actually handled this case for a period of time. So the guy is arrested in California, and then what happens, Jesse?
Well, he was kept almost incommunicado. He wasn't allowed to call his family, and his California lawyer, Randy Hamoud, was lied to by the Bureau of Prisons in San Diego about where Mr. Awadalla was. Ultimately, he was shipped cross-country incommunicado for about a week and wound up on October 2nd of 2001 in Manhattan at MCC at the federal courthouse.
And who was the judge he first made his appearance in front of?
On October 2nd, 2001, he appeared in front of Judge Mukasey.
Now, Judge Mukasey, of course, as our listeners know, has been nominated for Attorney General. And what happened at that hearing?
Well, initially, the prosecutor had tried to talk Mr. Awadallah's West Coast lawyer, Randy Hamoud, out of coming here, saying there was no need to make the cross-country trip. Now that you know that your client is here in New York, we'll have Criminal Justice Act attorney appointed for him, and we'll take care of it here. Mr. Hamoud said, no, I'm his lawyer. I'm coming to New York. And the prosecutor said, well, we can't delay the case. You've got to get here by tomorrow morning. So Randy Hamoud flew a red eye from San Diego the night of October 1st and arrived here on the morning of October 2nd, enlisted the assistance of Abdin Jabara, who's a local attorney here, an Arab-American attorney, who had participated in a trial here in Manhattan Federal Court a few years earlier, to work with him on the case. And the two of them showed up Randy Hamoud and Abdin Jabara showed up in Judge Mukasey's courtroom hoping to be able to represent Osama Awadallah here.
And then?
Well, Mr. Hamoud first tried to speak to Mr. Awadallah, and Mr. Awadallah complained to him of beatings he had received, including beatings on his arrival at MCC the night before.
MCC is the, what is it, Jesse?
The Correctional Center.
In Manhattan, right?
Across the street from the courthouse. Mr. Awadallah tried to show Randy Hamoud the beatings on his legs, but the marshal, a fellow named Scott Shepard, wouldn't let Mr. Awadallah lift up his pants legs to show the bruises. When the case was called in front of Judge Mukasey, one of the things that happened is that Randy Hamoud tried to tell Judge Mukasey about the beatings.
Hold on a second, Jesse. When it's called before Judge Mukasey, were there any spectators or witnesses or press in the courtroom?
I myself wasn't there. Because he was a grand jury witness, it was a sealed proceeding. So there would have been no press and no spectators there.
So this is really with Hamoud? I don't know if Jabbar, is Abdin Jabbar there?
Well, he was there for the beginning of the proceeding until Judge Mukasey kicked him out of the courtroom.
Okay, so you were going. So they go in the courtroom. There's Hamoud, Abdin Jabara, and
a federal prosecutor, Chris Morvillo,
right,
and Judge Mukasey, and Mr. Awadallah, and a few marshals, one of whom is this marshal, Scott Shepard.
So take us down two lines here. One, what happened with this allegation of a beating? What happened in the court?
Well, since Mr. Awadallah was wearing a prison jumpsuit with long pants legs and long sleeves, the bruises weren't visible, and the marshal wouldn't let him lift up or open up his pantsuit or his jumpsuit. The judge cavalierly said, he looks fine to me. And
this was in response to what the attorney said. What did the attorney say again?
That Mr. Awadallah had been beaten, but
right.
But the judge mocked Mr. Hamoud, saying, looks fine to me. You know, go sue if you want to, but I don't see anything.
He doesn't see anything. He has on the jumpsuit. It's to me, Jesse, one of the most remarkable lines that you could have from a federal judge. It's so nasty.
You'd be more likely to find it in Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
And what happened with Abdin?
Well, Abdin had been second chair or third chair in the Sheikh Abdul Rahman's case a few years earlier before Judge Mukasey. The prosecutor on Mr. Awadallah's case in October of 2001, at that time, Chris Morvillo, says to Judge Mukasey in these hearings, we think there's a conflict or there may be a conflict in Abdin's being one of the attorneys for Mr. Awadallah. No one says what that conflict was, but
certainly doesn't seem obvious.
Because the two cases weren't related. No one ever claimed the two cases
right.
were related. He just says, you know, remember, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the minutes right in front of me now, but Mr. Movillo raised the issue of there might be a conflict as to Abdin Jabara, and Judge Mukasey jumps on and says, absolutely, there's a conflict, and he kicks Abdin Jabara out of the courtroom. So of those 16 pages of proceedings that day, somewhere halfway through the proceedings, Abdin is actually booted out of the courtroom. Mr. Hamoud has to go by himself. Mr. Hamoud explains that he's not from New York, and in fact, he's not really a criminal practitioner. He was hired by the family of Mr. Awadallah in California to try to find out what happened to Mr. Awadallah, who had been scooped up and had disappeared for a week, and now he's in a strange courtroom in the other end of the land that is both Mr. Awadallah and Mr. Hamoud, who are at home in San Diego, but not here. Mr. Hamoud tries to bring a local practitioner in with him, who happens to be an Arab-American, and Judge Mukasey literally kicks him out of the courtroom without any specific explanation of what the conflict was. He just Judge Mukasey remembered Abdin because Abdin had appeared in front of him in the Sheik case.
Did he make some nasty comment about Abdin?
When Randy says, I'm paraphrasing, when Randy says...
Randy's the lawyer,
Randy
the other
Abud
lawyer.
Randy says, you know, I'm from California, I don't know the nuances of New York practice. Judge Mukasey says he doesn't think that Abdin Jabara knows much about New York, the nuances of New York practice either, although I don't remember the exact... he says,
unbelievable.
The court says, I got news for you. Mr. Jabara is not terribly familiar with the nuances either. His participation in that case was not extensive, although he did participate. He kicks him out of the case, even though he says that he was minimally involved in the Sheik case, and he doesn't articulate what conflict, if any, there was. He just says, oh, he was in the Sheik case, I'm kicking him out of this case. It's a conflict, I'm kicking him out of this case. Leaving you with the conclusion that the only thing in common is that these are cases involving Muslims, I suppose.
Jesse, I think that's right. Now, Jesse, there's a couple of lines I want to take you down. One is, what happened with the beating allegations ultimately?
When we got into pretrial hearings later on in February of 2002 before Judge Shinlin...
That's a different judge, right?
Yes. Well, first there was testimony that 2 days later, on October 4th, Mr. Hamoud and myself brought the bruises on Mr. Awadallah's body to the attention of three assistant U.S. attorneys and three FBI agents at a meeting on October 4th of 2001. At that time, Mr. Awadallah was wearing a sleeveless prison jumpsuit. We were able to show at least the bruises on his upper arms. And of course, you don't wear shackles on your upper arms, so there was no chance these bruises were just abrasions from shackles. We brought these to the attention of the U.S. Attorney's Office and to the FBI agents. At hearings in the case a few months later, in February of 2002, the two FBI agents, Jacqueline McGuire and Ryan Plunkett, acknowledged seeing those bruises on October 4th on Mr. Awadallah's upper arms. They couldn't deny it, but in their seven-page, single-space typed FBI 302 report about that session, they make absolutely no mention about the bruises. And when asked why, they said, well, the bruises were not what we were interested in at the time.
Now, I can't imagine why not, Jesse.
One of the assistant U.S. attorneys did call MCC and said, on October 4th, I think, and said, you know, have him examine, see if he really has any bruises. Or so a paramedic, or whatever they call them there at MCC, examined them that evening and documented eight different bruises on his arms, his legs, and on the back of his neck. Again, the back of his neck is another place where shackles aren't going to bruise you on the back of your neck. Clearly more consistent with beating than with just shackles that were too tight. Actually, that para did a wound chart documenting where on the body of Mr. Awadallah all these wounds appeared. At later proceedings, at the trials of Mr. Awadallah, the testimony of those two agents who acknowledged seeing the bruises was offered by us and the wound chart. There's no question that when Randy Hamoud was trying to bring to Judge Mukasey's attention that this is a man who had visible bruises on him, the judge was happier not being able to see anything and not wanting to see anything and just let it go at that, with mocking insults as to both to Randy and Abdin Jabara, and indeed knocking one of the two lawyers off the case, leaving only the California civil attorney, Randy Hamoud. It was later that afternoon that Randy came and hired me to come in on the case and as a New York local counsel, and I remained with that case for...
Now, what happened in the case ultimately?
Years. Ultimately, last November, I think 16th, jury acquitted Mr. Awadallah of all charges against him.
But he'd been held for 5 or 6 years?
No, had the case dangling over him for 5 years.
Oh.
He was held for about 3 months altogether until bail was set by Judge Shinlin. Mr. Awadallah's family and the Arab American community in San Diego got together and posted altogether $50,000 cash bail and co-signed for $500,000 bail, and one of Mr. Awadallah's brothers pledged his ice cream truck as part of the collateral for all of this. And within a few weeks after Judge Shinlin fixed that bail package, all the signatures and the cash bail and the signing over of the ice cream truck was in place. And in the second week of December of 2001, Mr. Awadallah was released from MCC, having been in custody approximately September 20th or 21st of 2001.
So, Jesse, I have really two questions. There's one that we always ask at, you know, when you and I have to give recommendations for young law students to become lawyers, they always ask a question that says, you know, what do you think of the fitness of this person, their moral character, to be a lawyer? You have to decide what you want to say about Judge Mukasey being Attorney General. But what do you think of Judge Mukasey's fitness to be Attorney General of the United States?
Well, some people make excuses for him, saying, you know, right after September 11th, these were hard times. Everybody was under a lot of pressure. But if we stop and think about it, in front of him was Osama Awadallah, a 21-year-old who'd never done anything wrong in his life, who nobody claims was really connected with 9/11 in any real way, who was from a different country. English wasn't his first language. He had been scooped up from San Diego, where he lived with his brothers and his family, and taken incommunicado across country for 7 days. He had been beaten, shackled, mocked for his ethnicity and his religion, and denied his Muslim food and prayer and all those things. And then he's brought in front of a judge in the relative calm of a courtroom in a courthouse where business was going on as usual. To excuse Judge Mukasey, saying, poor Judge Mukasey, you know, it's only 3 weeks after 9/11 and he's still in a state of shock or stress, when Judge Mukasey had absolutely no compassion for the person who was in front of him, who was not accused at that point of any crime, but just was a witness who had bumped into some people 2 years earlier, and theoretically the grand jury wanted to know what he could remember about them. For Judge Mukasey to be so hostile and so cynical and so abusive, and to me, it's just an attempt by the Giuliani campaign to get a foot in the door of the White House before, you know, before Bush's body is cold.
I think that's a good point. But he's very close to Giuliani, right?
Oh, he's acknowledged. He's part of Giuliani's campaign. Right. He is part of Giuliani's campaign.
It's a Trojan horse of the administration.
I mean, he's a member of the campaign, and he's a contributor to the campaign.
Oh, Jesse.
Longtime friend of Giuliani.
Okay, Jesse, thank you so much.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed the Center for Constitutional Rights case, charging Caterpillar, Inc. with aiding and abetting war crimes. Caterpillar is the company that provided bulldozers to Israel, knowing that they would be used to demolish homes and endanger civilians in the occupied Palestinian territory. The case, Corey et al. V. Caterpillar, Inc., was brought by the parents of Rachel Corey and four Palestinian families whose family members were killed or injured when Caterpillar bulldozers demolished their homes. Corey, a 23-year-old American peace activist and student at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, was killed on March 2003 in the Gaza Strip by a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer while protecting a home from illegal demolition. For years, Caterpillar has had notice that the IDF was using its D9 bulldozers for human rights violations. Despite this, the company has continued to provide them to the Israeli government. We talk now with Maria Luhud, senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Maria, just for listeners who may not be familiar with the case, although we've had you on before, could you give us a brief synopsis of what CCR brought in court and where we are with the procedural history?
Sure. CCR represents Rachel Corey's parents, Craig and Cindy Corey. Rachel was killed in Gaza while trying to protect a home from being demolished while the family was still inside. We also represent four Palestinian families who were inside their homes when their homes were demolished on top of them. So 11 people were killed, including children, an elderly, and a disabled man, and several people were injured. The case is against Caterpillar because, as I said, they had been selling the bulldozers to the Israel Defense Forces, knowing that they would be used in violation of international law to demolish homes, civilian property, without military necessity. And so we allege that they were aiding and abetting war crimes. The case was dismissed in the lower court for various reasons. And recently, unfortunately, that dismissal was affirmed in the Ninth Circuit.
Hmm. On what basis did the Ninth Circuit affirm that?
You know, just one reason. It refused to decide whether or not Caterpillar, in fact, was aiding and abetting war crimes, basically because the U.S. government paid for the bulldozers that Israel bought from Caterpillar. So the court said it was not going to reach Caterpillar's liability because to do so would question the U.S. foreign policy, really, of encouraging Israel to purchase bulldozers from Caterpillar, which on a number of levels I think is an error. I mean, first of all, it wasn't clear on the record that the bulldozers used here were actually financed by the U.S. government. We should have had discovery on that issue. Caterpillar submitted, you know, one contract saying that, you know, the United States had approved the funding for a sale of 50 bulldozers, and then the U.S. government came in at the appellate stage, not in the lower court, saying that, yes, all the bulldozers at issue were financed by the U.S. government, but never, of course, describing what bulldozers were at issue. So the court just assumed that all bulldozers ever sold to Israel have been financed by the U.S. government, which is just not true. I mean, the bigger question really is what is U.S. foreign policy here? And I don't think it can be that Israel should purchase Caterpillar bulldozers. I mean, even if you look at the program under which these bulldozers were allegedly financed, the purpose of that program is to support defense relationships in order to foster international peace and security, certainly not to foster human rights violations.
I just heard a speech by Professor Alain Pappe, who is an Israeli professor now teaching at Oxford. And he and other Israeli historians have gotten documentation that's recently been released by the Israeli government. And it indicates, and they're called the revisionist historians because they revised the old view of Israel defended itself in the 1948 war and they're hanging on against this external threat. And the revisionist historians, including Alain Pappe, are saying the whole 1948 war was an example of ethnic cleansing, discussed and planned in 47, and that some 538 Arab villages were destroyed, 750,000 Palestinians were driven out to make room for the Zionist colonial project. My question is, in that framework, my view of what Caterpillar was doing in demolishing these Palestinian homes is in line with what I would view as a whole ethnic cleansing project that goes all the way back to the foundations of the Israeli colonial project.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, the complaint that we've alleged that Caterpillar has been selling bulldozers at least since 67 to Israel, and it's known at least for the past few decades that those bulldozers have been used to unlawfully demolish homes in the occupied Palestinian territory. And that's one of the ways, of course, in which Israel attempts to eliminate and take over eliminate Palestinians and take over the land.
Well, what can you do now?
Well, we're deciding what we can do. I mean, the one thing we can do is we can ask the same panel of judges who made this decision to rehear it and to perhaps, you know, send it back to the district court and allow discovery to really find out how these bulldozers are sold and really what involvement the U.S. has. It seems to us that even if they are financed, it could just be a ministerial approval. We could also ask the full en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit to hear the case or to rehear it. We haven't decided how to proceed, but we will be deciding in the next week.
The court turning its back on you reminds me of the fate of the play about Rachel Corrie last winter here in New York. This wonderful play about Rachel was set to go on. There was so much pressure put on the producers of the play by the Zionist power structure here in New York City that the play was closed down. You try to get a hearing on what happened there, and you can't get it on a stage or even in a courtroom.
Right. I think also even in a more largely tragic sense, I think it's to Rachel's story especially, I mean, you know, she tried to stop a bulldozer from demolishing a home, and she couldn't because that bulldozer was backed by the United States government. Yeah, and that's the same reason that the court stopped the case here.
At the oral arguments, did you have any clue that the court was leaning in this direction?
You know, we didn't. We actually came out of that argument hoping that at least they would be remanding on the political question issue. It was interesting because, you know, they even, the chief judge who authored the opinion, you know, questioned the government about why they didn't come in at the district court level and saying that they couldn't submit evidence at this stage, at the appellate stage. You know, there was also quite a bit of discussion about the merits of the claims, which we felt good about. You know, one thing that happened was one of the judges asked the U.S. government, well, what if, you know, when the U.S. government claiming, of course, that these claims couldn't be war crimes and they couldn't be aiding and abetting war crimes, and the government said, well, what about if during World War II a U.S. corporation had sent ovens, you know, to Nazi Germany, and those were used in concentration camps? And the U.S. government said, yes, that would be a war crime. So, yeah. I mean, it's really unfortunate. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, yes, we've known that it's difficult to bring this kind of case, unfortunately, because people often have more sort of emotional and political reactions when Israel is involved instead of just looking at whether or not the law has been violated.
We're speaking with Maria LaHood, remind listeners who have just tuned in, who's an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the lead attorney in the case against Caterpillar Corporation, the corporation that makes specially made 60-ton bulldozers. They're enormous, and sells them to the Israeli government for the customized use in Palestinian home demolitions. Maria, tell us a little bit more about Rachel Corey and what happened that day when that bulldozer ran her over.
Well, you know, Rachel was in Gaza with the International Solidarity Movement, and, you know, she was involved in a lot of activities in Gaza, walking students to school to protect them from being shot. You know, one of the things she was doing was trying to protect homes from being demolished. So her and another, you know, and a group of International Solidarity Movement activists became aware that in Rafah, in the southern border of Gaza, where the wall was being built, that there were bulldozers getting ready to demolish homes. And one of the homes was the Nasrallah family, where Rachel had actually stayed.
The local pharmacist?
Yeah. They were in the home. And so Rachel and the other ISM activists, you know, were stood around the home, and Rachel had an orange jacket on, and the bulldozer, which that same team before had been sort of getting dangerously close to people, and it's our understanding that they were actually ordered to continue demolition, even with protesters present. The bulldozer approached her, and, you know, she sort of built up the mound of dirt under which she got caught and proceeded to run her over intentionally. There are eyewitness accounts saying that, you know, the other ISM people were waving their hands in front of the bulldozer to stop it. And there was another tank there, too, that she was intentionally killed while trying to protect the Nasrallah family's home. And
didn't the Israelis say that it was necessary to demolish this home because the terrorists were building tunnels under it?
You know, that's been rumored. If they did stake out that position earlier, I think they dropped that. I mean, I don't know if they have or not, but the home wasn't demolished then for several months after. There was certainly never any evidence that was the truth. I mean, it's often an excuse for these home demolitions, which really are just collective punishment and in order to take land and in order, in this case, you know, to build a buffer between the wall that they were building. So it's people raise that issue, but no, it's not true.
Maria, these aren't regular bulldozers, are they? Can you tell us what's different about them?
Well, they are, first of all, as Michael said, they're enormous. They're, you know, maybe 60 tons. They're probably almost 13 feet high, 26 feet wide. They are militarized and armored. There is mixed evidence about whether or not Caterpillar actually armors them or whether they're armored in Israel, but they are at least created and designed in order to be armored. So again, these aren't the little yellow bulldozers you see in the street that are just, you know, clearing the road. These are bulldozers that are capable of demolishing concrete homes in a matter of minutes and are protected from, you know, in a military way.
Had you been able to proceed to discovery, would you have anticipated national security arguments for not divulging certain information about them?
You know, I'm not really sure if they would claim that. I'm not sure how they could, but anything's possible.
You know, we had Joel Covell on the show mm-hmm. several times. He dedicated his recent book, Overcoming Zionism, which lays out a solution to have a unitary democratic state for everybody that lives there. Mm-hmm. And he dedicated the book in part to Rachel Corrie, and he said, Rachel Corrie, may her name live in glory. Just as a footnote to that, his book was being distributed by the University of Michigan Press. Campus Watch, which is kind of a thought police operation, pressured the university to drop distributing his book. It's been restored to their list, but now the University of Michigan has been pressured to drop the whole line of Pluto books from England, including Joel's book, where they distribute. So, you know, you try to get this story out about Rachel Corrie and these bulldozers. It was a whole chapter in Joel's right. book. You know, you face the tremendous power of the lobby. So what you're doing with the center in keeping this litigation going and getting the story out is really admirable, Maria, and we're here in solidarity with you.
Thank you.
Maria, what's happening in terms of the movement? Outrage? Anything planned to protest this?
As far as I know, there is a day of action plan for October 19th. Information about it is available on the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation website. The 19th is the month anniversary of the most recent killing by a bulldozer in Gaza, where there was a home demolition operation going on. 13 homes were demolished, and a 19-year-old was shot and then run over by a bulldozer and killed.
Another tragedy. We'll put a link to that on our website. We'll hope to keep up to date with you on any further developments, Maria.
It's Thank you.
It's been a pleasure once again to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Maria.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
We talk with the executive director and the legal director of the Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice. They're a national nonprofit organization that provides legal support and advocacy for working people in their communities, basically holding corporations and governments accountable to their legal and moral responsibilities regarding illegal and abusive working conditions. Recently, the Sugar Law Center has handled cases involving Walmart and Wackenhut, the private prison corporation. We have today Tova Perlmutter, Executive Director of the Sugar Law Center.
Tova, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Tova, the Sugar Center, when it came into being, I was so thrilled to see that your good work would honor the, not famous, because if we had working people writing history rather than the people who do write our history, sugar would be a household word in the United States, but he's not. But when I saw that it was going to be called the Sugar Center, I remembered the stories about Sugar, who was the great attorney for the auto workers when they were struggling to form the United Auto Workers Union back in the 30s. I remember that he was then the founder of what became the Goodman Crockett firm, which when I was practicing in Detroit was the great movement law firm in the city. Then I saw that the Sugar Center was formed initially with grants that came out of the Goodman Crockett firm. So I wanted to ask you for your reminiscences about Maurice Sugar. I know he wrote that famous song, Soup Song.
That's right.
And I'm not going to embarrass you by asking you to sing it, although Heidi might.
If I had a little prep, you might have gotten me to. No, I think actually Maurice Sugar is a wonderful example of the kind of person that really was such a model for all of us, because not only did he have his political passions and really do tremendous legal work on behalf of the movement, but he also was someone who saw the importance of the cultural side of a movement, and he wrote folks, well, I guess we don't call them folk songs if we know who wrote them, but popular songs that, you know, including the Soup Song, but others as well. He also was one of the people behind the creation of the Buck Dinner in Detroit. I won't go into the details on that.
I've been to Buck Dinners.
I bet you have.
That's when all the guys in the Goodman firm would go up north, go deer hunting, they'd bring back the meat, and they'd have a dinner and eat deer meat.
That's right.
I don't think that's as PC now as it was 40 years ago.
They didn't just eat it, but they when they first started doing it, it was in the height of the Depression, and they were providing a meal for really anybody who needed it. it's turned into a real fundraiser for social action and social justice organizations throughout the Detroit area. But at its beginning, it was really come, take what you need, give what you can, which is, you know, of course, a wonderful idea. I have to say that being a Jew from Philadelphia myself, I was shocked when I found out that these lefty union Jews from the 30s were actually going out and hunting and killing deer. It didn't really sit with my understanding of our culture, but I'll tell you, they did some great things.
What were your people, hunter and gatherers?
No, you know, more of the small merchants, you know, run a little luncheonette, give people a little soup.
Well, tell us what the mission of the Sugar Center is.
I'm happy to. The Sugar Law Center, our mission is really to help the disenfranchised, the oppressed, and those struggling for social justice in any way, shape, or form. We have, over the years, really focused most, although certainly not all, of our efforts, which include both litigation, policy, as well as research. Most of our efforts have been focused on workplace rights. And as I say, that's not to the exclusion of other forms of economic justice, but really with the understanding that people's chance of a decent livelihood and a dignified existence for their family does depend very strongly on what rights the law entitles them to in the workplace and how well they're able to enforce those rights. And that's really something that is underserved throughout the U.S. Many progressive lawyers, as I'm sure you're both aware, are very focused, as they need to be, on all of our civil rights, on questions like police misconduct. There's certainly an abundance of issues on which people need to fight back. But the base issue of how are your conditions at work? Are you getting paid for the work that you're doing? Are you getting paid decently? And, you know, do you have a chance to advance without discrimination? These issues really are underserved.
We're really interested in hearing about some of the work that you've been doing with Walmart and Wackenhut. Could you give us an overview of how you got into this line
Absolutely.
Of work?
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to. And, of course, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, the share of the private sector workforce in the U.S. that is unionized has been declining steadily until the point where now in the private sector, I believe it's around 8% of workers actually are members of unions.
And Walmart's not unionized.
Walmart is absolutely not
unionized. And I know you've been litigated with them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, so we were contacted by a few of these major unions that are trying to unionize some of these mega corporations, as Heidi described. Our first arrangement was with the United Food and Commercial Workers, who are trying to reform Walmart, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. And then we've more recently formed a similar arrangement with the Service Employees International Union in their campaign to unionize Wackenhut Security Industries, which is a whole set of companies that provide essentially guard services around the world, actually.
And now also private prison work.
Oh. In any event, these unions are really taking a different approach that I think is really essential. And again, you may well be aware of it, but it's being called comprehensive campaigns. And the idea is that when you're dealing with these massive, massive corporations that have, of course, terribly deep pockets and are willing to go to any lengths to prevent workers from unionizing, that if you try to organize on a site-by-site basis where you hold an election at one work site and then you manage to gather cards, hold an election at another work site, that you really are up against sort of repeatedly the enormous resources of the other side without gaining a whole lot of traction. And so the concept of the comprehensive campaign is really to go after public opinion and put pressure on the management of the entire corporation to really understand that it will cost them something not to deal with unions. What we've been involved in is that what both of these unions are trying to do as they tackle these big companies is they are inviting individual workers to tell their stories of what has happened to them. And, of course, the unions want these stories so that they can identify the right organizing issues and the right issues on which to exert pressure. But the unions also feel strongly that they want to provide real help to these individual workers, even though the workers are not yet members and may not anytime soon be union members. They want to be able to give them help in pursuing their individual claims. And that, too, can be a form of pressure on the company. Not to mention, if enough of the claims look like they put together a pattern, then there could be room for a class action, which could, of course, be quite powerful in forcing these companies to the table. We take the calls. It's now gotten to be hundreds of calls that come in to us from workers anywhere in the country who work for these behemoth corporations. And when they have a problem, an issue at work where their supervisor has done the wrong thing, they call us to see what legal action is possible. If they have a case that actually can lead to redress in court, we will find them a local attorney who is on side, understands the issues, and will work with us to help them press their individual claim.
When this happens, do the employees experience workplace retaliation?
Excellent question. I would say, to the extent that the workers are making issues out of these claims, of course, many of them are experiencing retaliation, and John will give you some examples of that. On the other hand, I don't think that their involvement of us as a resource has yet been recognized by the corporate entities or the local managers, who generally are the ones responsible for the retaliation. I don't think we've been recognized as a piece of that. I think we're sort of under the radar.
Under the radar, I was going to say.
Yeah. I mean, we are a resource. We're helping folks. Frankly, a lot of the time, what we help them with is not even necessarily getting formal representation, but understanding how to frame their claim within the company system so that they can get better treatment. Even an EEOC hearing, any of which may not require them to have an attorney present, but boy, they can sure use some advice on how to present themselves to the arbitrator.
And Tova, I assume that the center is keeping meticulous records about all of these claims.
Oh, you should see our database.
And if somebody wanted to call you, what number would they call?
They tend to call through the unions, and I'll get John to give out that information. Certainly anyone who wants to can always call us directly, and they don't have to be associated with either of these employers, can always call us directly. Unfortunately, we do not have an 800 number, but 313-962-6540. We're happy to hear from workers anywhere who are having a problem with their boss. If there's legal action to be taken, we will help them find representation. Sometimes there isn't, and sometimes, unfortunately, we have to say to people, you're getting screwed, but there's no legal recourse.
We can help. Thank you, Tova.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tova.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.